The Siberian tiger is the largest cat in the world. Larger than the African lion, it is 10 to 12 feet long and weighs about 600 pounds in the wild. It's lighter in color than the Bengal tiger and is equipped for dealing with the cold and snow with longer fur and huge feet. My guest, Maurice Hornacker, is the co-founder of the Siberian Tiger Project. He's working with the Russians to study the tiger and protect it from extinction. He wrote the introduction and took the photographs for Peter Matheson's new book, Tigers in the Snow. Hornacker also studied the American mountain lion and directs the Hornacker Wildlife Institute at the University of Idaho. Tigers are a secretive species, so it's difficult to directly observe them. Instead, Hornacker and his team observe them indirectly by attaching collars carrying small radio transmitters to the tigers' necks. The transmitters send identifying signals, allowing the researchers to follow the tiger's movements. In order to attach the collar, the researchers have to first capture the tiger. I asked Hornacker how that's done.
Well, with a system that was developed here in the Pacific Northwest for the capture of bears on timber reservations where bears were damaging young trees, it's a cable system, a snare cable system. It's a padded cable that we attach to a drag or to a tree. It doesn't snap close with tight with force, but the animal steps within this loop, and the loop is sprung by a light spring that just tightens the loop around the ankle of the animal. We developed it for cats, the first ever species of cat that this system was used on mountain lions in New Mexico. In most of the western U.S., to capture lions, you must use trained dogs. But in the area where we were working in southern New Mexico, there were no trees, and it was difficult to use dogs there. So we experimented and evolved the use of this snare system, which worked very, very effectively on mountain lions. It worked really quite effectively on Siberian tigers as well.
And once you capture the tiger, do you have to temporarily knock the tiger out so that you can approach it and put on the radio collar?
That's correct. And again, and this is a well-developed technology over the last 3 to 4 decades of tranquilization with a different tranquilizing drugs. And they're fired in propulsion syringes that on impact inject the drug agent into the tiger. So we approach them, fire these compressed air rifles with the darts in them at the animal. It tranquilizes them, and then we have hour and a half to perform all of the different tasks that we do with each of these animals. Besides attaching the collar, we measure them, we weigh them, we check the condition, overall physical condition. We take blood samples. We take tissue samples for genetic analysis at a later time. Quite a number of photographs of each individual tiger. And each tiger, above each eye, has an individual fingerprint, you might say. No two of these are alike, so individual tigers can be identified by those marks above their eyes.
So if you have a few minutes left over, you know, while the tiger's still tranquilized and you've done the work you've needed to do, do you just sit around petting the tiger? I mean, this is your only chance, probably, to actually pet the tiger.
Oh, yeah, we have affection for some of these, a great affection for some of these animals. One we named Olga, the first tiger we ever captured in February of 92, 8 years ago this month. She's worn radio collar since that time. We've replaced her collar 3 different times. She's raised 3 litters of cubs. We think she has another litter now. So we become quite familiar with these animals. They become old friends. And even though we're observing them indirectly.
I know several of the tigers that you've been monitoring have been killed by poachers. What's in it for the poachers to kill the tigers? What do they get out of it?
Well, they get a lot of money. It's a serious problem throughout Asia. The ancient Oriental medicine of dictates that tiger parts are good for you, and so there is monetary reward for those who are willing to take the risk. It's illegal to kill a tiger, and we've tightened up a lot on the poaching. It isn't nearly the threat that it was a few years back, but it still happens. It would be like in Idaho or the western U.S. offering a cowboy $10,000 for a bald eagle. Some would be willing to take the risk for that amount of money. And sadly, this is true in Russia as well.
Is it very upsetting for you when a tiger who you've come to know is murdered?
Oh, yes. It's like the loss of an old friend.
My guest is Maurice Hornacker, and he's the co-director of the Siberian Tiger Project and director of the Hornacker Wildlife Institute at the University of Idaho. He collaborated with Peter Matheson on the new book, Tigers in the Snow. This new book has several photographs that you've taken over the years of tigers, and I just particularly like one of them. This is a photo that reminds me of how a pet cat looks when it's on its hind legs with its front paws on the scratching post.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a
mm-hmm.
huge tiger on its hind legs, and its front paws are on a tree, you know, the bark of a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And this led me to wonder, are there any personality or any personality similarities you found between tigers and pet cats?
Oh, great many. Domestic cats, house cats, and Siberian tigers have so many traits in common.
Like
cats
what?
Truly are cats. The play, scratching the trees, scent marking, burying their feces, a great many different behaviors are so alike, and you see in your pet house cat. It goes way back to when I first became so interested in the cats. I could see in my daughter's pet house cat. So many of those behaviors that we learned were common in all the species of wild cats that I've worked with.
How do the big cats, how do the tigers behave around people?
Tigers are shy. Siberian tigers are shy and avoid contact with people. There are incidents of physical contact, of tigers attacking people. There have even been fatalities. But this is a rare occurrence. And for the most part, just like our North American mountain lion, most individuals avoid people, stay out of contact. This isn't the case in some of the other Asian countries where tigers are much more aggressive toward people. But the Siberian is shy and tries to stay, for the most part, away from humans and human development.
Now, I believe you raised a couple of the tiger cubs after the mother was killed by poachers. What did you learn about raising the cubs, about nature versus nurture?
The cubs were, we really didn't raise the cubs. They were raised by Professor Eugen, a professor in the Soviet Academy of Sciences who had studied the behavior of wolves and other leopards, other carnivores. When we first arrived in, Howard Quigley and I first arrived in Siberia 10 years ago, we met Professor Eugen, and he told us he had these cubs. Their mother had been shot in a remote village, orphaning the cubs. He had obtained them and had them there in Vladivostok at the time, and he told us of his plans for building a large enclosure at a remote village some 200 kilometers from Vladivostok and doing behavioral work with them. So we collaborated with Dr. Eugen, and over the years at his enclosure devised some different experiments to determine what was innate behavior and what was learned behavior. And it helped us. You have to be careful with these kinds of experiments. You can't replicate them many times, so scientifically you have to be a bit careful. But it did help us understand some of the behaviors of wild tigers, those living in the wild. An example, none of our Russian colleagues felt that tigers could climb trees. We, for no real reason, didn't think tigers could climb trees either. We devised some experiments there to see. We attached pieces of wild boar hide in small oak trees with some fishing line attached to them, and to get the lion's attention or the tiger's attention, we would move these. This huge tiger, 500-pound male tiger, just went up that tree like a squirrel. The Russians were amazed. And, of course, we got this on film. So that's an example of what one can do with lions in a natural environment, natural as far as the vegetation's concerned and all that, with some experiments to determine what is nature and what is nurture.
My guest is Maurice Hornocker, co-founder of the Siberian Tiger Project. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Maurice Hornocker. He's the co-director of the Siberian Tiger Project and director of the Hornocker Wildlife Institute at the University of Idaho. He's collaborated with Peter Matheson on the new book, Tigers in the Snow. We've all heard a lot about how the collapse of communism has affected the people of the former Soviet Union. How has it affected the tigers?
It had a devastating effect at first. Ironically, under the communist government, tiger numbers grew robustly in far eastern Russia. And the Sakhoti-Alin Reserve was the centerpiece of that population growth. After the borders opened, after the communist government fell, poaching was rampant throughout the range. We were there at the time. We were working through the government changeover and all. And poaching on the prey species of the tigers, wild boar and elk, was also quite prevalent. But with international support from a number of other organizations, as well as our own foundation, has brought a lot of that under control. It's still a problem, but it's not nearly such a severe problem as it was immediately following the communist collapse.
Are the Siberian tigers close to extinction?
Well, they're too close for comfort. Our last census, region-wide census, two winters ago, confirmed 450 in the wild, and that includes young. That isn't very many. It's many more than a few years earlier, and we have cause to believe that that number is increasing. With our information from our research, we've developed a conservation plan. Dr. Dale McKell, our supervisor in Russia, has developed this plan and submitted it to the Supreme Russian Authority in Moscow, and they've adopted it as part of the Russian plan for conservation of the tiger. It involves saving the environment as well as the tiger. In any conservation plan, we have to consider the political, the economic, the cultural situation as well with people. And some international programs have failed because they simply didn't do that. Well, here we've tried to cooperate with the Russians from day one. We've hired their scientists, we've hired their students, we have Russian technicians. We've made it truly a Russian-American project. And so we speak with a unified voice to the government in Moscow, which is the ultimate authority. So we feel that this plan to conserve the environment is based on sound science, is the best in the long run for saving the tiger from extinction and increasing those numbers. We'd like to see many more than the 450, of course.
I guess you can't save the tiger if the trees are cut down and there's an urban landscape around them. You have to save the environment to save the tigers.
That's correct. And it doesn't mean not cutting any trees. It doesn't mean not mining any resources, mineral resources. It means doing it the right way. It's the same as management of the lands here in the western United States. If it's done the right way, it can benefit tigers. Timber harvest is an example, because if we harvest timber in the proper way, we can even enhance the forest because of the new plant species that come in, enhance the forest for elk and wild boar, two major food sources for tigers, which in turn enhances the tiger's environment. So we don't say hands off completely. We say let's do it the right way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thank you, Ms. Gross. I appreciate it.
Maurice Hornocker is the co-founder of the Siberian Tiger Project and director of the Hornocker Wildlife Institute at the University of Idaho. He wrote the introduction and took the photographs for Peter Matheson's new book, Tigers in the Snow.